In his very first week in office, President Biden signed a pledge titled Executive Order on Advancing Racial Equity and Support for Underserved Communities Through the Federal Government. It says the, quote, country faces converging economic, health, and climate crises that have exposed and exacerbated inequities, while a historic movement for justice has highlighted the unbearable human costs of systemic racism.
And I firmly believe the nation is ready to change, but government has to change as well. We need to make equity and justice part of what we do every day.
And today, Biden signs another executive order, this one to advance gender equity. But what does equity mean when it comes to government policy? Is there a difference between equity and equality? Well, equity has become a sticking point in some of the confirmation hearings for Biden's cabinet. In January, during her hearings, Marcia Fudge, Biden's nominee for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, offered this definition.
Home ownership. Let's take it that way. They say let's make everything equal. But it's not equal because even though I meet all of the qualifications to qualify for home for a loan, you know, I've got the right credit scores, etc., but I don't have down payment money. Because my parents can't afford to give me down payment. There is no wealth coming to me. Where most people who are not, that don't look like me, have options that I do not have. So just to say you treat us all the same is not the same. Equity means making the playing field level. Sometimes it's not level if you just say, let's just treat everybody the same.
Vice President Kamala Harris added further clarity to the administration's approach late last month.
Yes, we want everyone to get an equal amount, that sounds right, but not everyone starts out from the same place. Some people start out on first base, some people start out on third base. And if the goal is truly about equality, it has to be about a goal of saying everybody should end up in the same place. And since we didn't start in the same place, some folks might need more. Equitable distribution.
Well, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution enshrines Americans' right to equal protection under the law. But it seems that in the Biden administration, equity has a meaningfully different definition than equality. So what does it mean for the whole of American government to work towards equity instead? Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour on Point, we're going to explore the overlap and some of the tensions between the concepts of equity and equality in America. And we'll start today with Robert Patterson. He's a professor of African American Studies at Georgetown University, currently at work on a book titled Black Equity, Black Equality, Reparation and Black Communities. Professor Patterson, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So I feel like this is almost a whole hour whose soul dwells in definitions. So let's start right there. I mean, how would you define what you see as equity meaning today?
Right. So equity today. So one of the challenges of defining equity is that we sort of can't do it without necessarily thinking about equality to speak to this tension that you had illuminated well. And so when we think about equality, for example, we think about sameness, giving everyone, for example, an equal amount, giving everyone so if there are 10 houses to be distributed, we would just give everyone, you know, two each, right? And it doesn't necessarily account for the present standing that's sort of based on a history that has impacted where those people are. So when we think of equity, by contrast, we're thinking about what are the resources that are needed that would account for, to Vice President Harris's point, different starting points, right? So if you're on a different base, that would account for the accumulation of wealth or, in some cases, the accumulation of poverty, and how to describe or how to prescribe those resources in a way that the outcomes are similar. And so equality has often been about having the same access, whereas equity is trying to get the same outcome. And in order to get the same outcome, there may need to be different access points because people are not in the starting place. Same starting place.
Okay. So right there, I think, is where there's the tension in acknowledging or looking at policies that would purport to lead to similar outcomes.
Right.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, right. And so you quoted the Marsha Fudge, you know, the Secretary of HUD, the comment she made in her statement. And so after she made that statement, I think it was the senator from Kentucky, the junior senator Rand Paul, who then said, oh, so then is it okay to treat people differently based on race? And so I think this might be what you're getting at the tension is that what she's saying, essence, I think what we all are saying is it is appropriate to have these differential resources that are, you know, that we find ourselves along racial lines or along gender lines, as thinking of the executive order that President Biden signed today. But yes, but not in the way that historically, right, groups for civil rights and women's rights have been fighting against the differential treatment, because that differential treatment was to deny access, to deny outcome. And it was that differential treatment that has made the need for equity. And so it's this interesting moment where, on the one hand, we are saying, yes, there is different treatment. That same treatment is not going to close the gap.
Okay. Same treatment is not going to close the gap. Hold that thought, because I want to come back to it. But regarding definitions, I mean, in terms of how the Biden administration itself, separate from speeches, but in actual policy, might enact an equity agenda. I'm looking at the executive order from
right.
January, right? And the first part contains a definition, right? And it says, quote,
right.
The term equity means the consistent and systematic, fair, just, and impartial treatment of all individuals, including individuals who belong to underserved communities that have been denied
right.
such treatment. So that's
right,
about
right.
impartial treatment, though, not about outcomes.
Right. But but the treatment is relevant to the outcome. And so I think that in that definition, part of what the executive order is toying with is what justice looks like. And so when you get into these conversations about equity, for example, justice and sameness are not interchangeable. And also the impartiality. So part of I think what you're getting at, too, is that perhaps the wording of this could be different. But the impartiality is accounting for the notion that there is partiality in how these communities are currently treated.
Mm-hmm.
And so a resonant example in terms of policy. So let's go back to the PPP. You know, the loans for the during COVID. So basically, you know, for a 2-week period in February, it was targeted, right? Some people might use the terminology limited, but it was targeted. It was targeted to small businesses and businesses owned by underrepresented groups. And part of what that targeting of that program did was it accounted for all of the stories that were even acknowledged under the last administration, where because of the way that a policy that sort of, quote unquote, treated every business the same, when in reality it didn't treat every business the same, but it put those businesses at disadvantages. And part of why those businesses were at disadvantages was because on the one hand, it's saying everybody was treated the same, but the system itself is organized in such a way that smaller businesses and historically underrepresented owned businesses are at a disadvantage in that system. And so it's just a very interesting, I think that part of what the challenge is in articulating what equity is and how it's different from equality, and really just thinking through how it plays out, is that equity at its core fundamentally goes against some of the very values that Americans are largely invested in, even if they're not productive. And that's issues around sameness, fairness, meritocracy, colorblindness in the post-civil rights era, and so forth. And so all of those notions, when not understood in their complexity, can sort of lead to this notion that there's some unfair advantage in equity, when in reality, equity is trying to close the systemic disadvantages that have been rendered under the current system.
Well, Professor Patterson, I think right there you hit the nail on the head, right? With a sledgehammer, in fact, because that is the tension about broad-based historical conceptions of sort of Americanness and particularly American values with how equity is being defined. Okay, so we're going to come back to that. But I do want to just step back in time a little because this isn't the first time that a president has spoken about equity. So let's go to 1965. President Lyndon Johnson speaking to the graduating class of Howard University.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair.
President Johnson then went on to tie the example of running a race to equity and equality.
We seek not just freedom, but opportunity. We seek not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result.
Professor Patterson, hearing those words, roughly 60 years later, what do you think? We've just got a minute to go before our next break.
No, absolutely. So I think that it just shows you how the circularity of history. And so he makes these comments in 1965, and this is around the same time. I think this actually coincides right around the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 65. You get the Fair Housing and Economic Act of 68. And so part of what happens during the 60s is you have the legal removal of Jim Crow, which is supposed to then allow equal opportunity and access. But in the 70s, and going forward, we see all of these assaults on those legislative achievements. You know, we see that the law itself is actually designed, and the Supreme Court has reaffirmed places that disadvantage, you know, underrepresented groups. And so this is where we are, and this is why we're here now.
Well, this hour we are talking about the concepts of equity, not in the real estate terms, and equality, and what that means in terms of practice when it comes to policies from the government. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are talking about the overlap and the tensions between the concepts of equity and equality, especially when it comes to government policy in the Biden administration. I'm joined today by Professor Robert Patterson. He's a professor of African American Studies at Georgetown University, currently at work on a book titled Black Equity, Black Equality, Reparation, and Black Communities. And we've been getting a lot of feedback from listeners over social media. You can find us on Twitter, at Facebook, at On Point Radio. For example, on Facebook, Ray Russell says, what's fair is equal opportunity, not equal outcome. Keep in mind, there will never be equal everything. All you can do is come as close as possible. We've also been hearing from listeners who've given us a call about this. On Point listener Austin left us a voicemail from Oklahoma. He's always felt that every American deserves an equal opportunity.
I think from time immemorial, there's people who do things similar ways and similar efforts, even from similar backgrounds, and they never achieve the same result twice. Whether it's, you know, companies, CEOs, scientific experiments, or people who grow up in the same household, you can have the same experience growing up and the same opportunities and, you know, siblings will split entirely separate ways, and some become successful and some don't. And part of that's a measure of how you define success. Some people, for, you know, success is having a family that's, you know, well-rounded and respectful and meets together frequently, and other people it's monetary success.
Austin added that he thinks equality of outcome should not be a guarantee for American citizens.
I think that's the beautiful thing about our country is you can pick yourself up and try again. And it's the point where we blame an outsider or another for our stumblings or our fallings, and we don't get back up again, that we've hurt our fellow citizens.
On the other hand, Richard from Oregon called us and gave us this definition of equity.
If I give $100 to three people, that's equality. The one who already had $100 now has $200. The one who had $50 now has $150. The one who had $25 now has $125. That's equality. But to be equitable, I would give each the amount that they need to result in all three having $200. The question then in my mind is, do we actually care about bringing every citizen up to an equitable level that provides the means of accessing opportunities to further improve their lives?
Just some of the large variety of responses we've been getting from On Point listeners for this hour. So, Professor Patterson, hang on here with us because I want to introduce now into the conversation Mike Gonzalez. He's a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. Mike Gonzalez, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna, and hi, Robert Patterson. I'm very happy to be on here with you. I've been listening to the conversation. This is very important.
Do you think equity and equality are meaningfully different, or are we just sort of struggling over definitions at the margins?
No, these are really important differences. I mean, traditionally, equity did mean more or less the same as equality. The meaning has now been corrupted, first in the academy many years ago, and now this has been adopted very worryingly by the Biden administration. I think Robert Patterson hit the nail on the head when he said that the adoption of the concept of unequal treatment according to race and other categories violates cherished American concepts. And it does. That's the reason why there's so much pushback. And it's not just norms, right? But it violates the Constitution itself. Every American deserves equal treatment under the law, and the president and the entire executive branch should be focused on ensuring that equality is protected and afforded to all. That, I would say to Robert Patterson, that is what justice looks like. So, yes, Meghna, I am concerned that the Biden administration seems to be attempting to do the opposite.
Professor Patterson, I'll let you respond in just one second, but I want to also quickly ask Mike Gonzalez. You know, Professor Patterson also talked a few minutes ago about how the Biden administration's one of their stated goals regarding equity of outcome, in what areas of American life we can talk about in a minute, but equity of outcome. He was saying that perhaps produces a tension in people because it challenges some what have been historic American values regarding meritocracy, et cetera. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The government cannot guarantee equal outcomes. And this is, again, what Vice President Kamala Harris she says that. She's a leading proponent of this. President Biden is following along. It's so frenetic the way they're pushing this. Equal outcomes cannot be guaranteed. We make different choices in life. We have different faculties. And we have many, many different subcultures in this vast country of ours where what matters to you, what is important in terms of self-respect, has a lot to do with the decisions that you make. So promising equal outcomes, first, it's impossible, but it's not even a goal worth pursuing. It's actually unfair.
Professor Patterson, your response?
Yeah, I have a couple of things to say. If, in fact, I misspoke earlier and said, to quote Mike, but basically that equity was problematic, then that's actually not what I'm at. I actually do think that equity is important. You know, this idea that one of the callers, I think it was Ray, or noted on Facebook, something about equal outcome. I think that what we're really getting at is trying to get outcomes that are more on par. We know that everybody won't necessarily have the same outcome. At the same time, I think it's important that we be careful about what these founding documents did, right? So as someone who is Black, I would have been counted as three-fifths of a person in the Constitution. So this notion that we somehow in violation of the Constitution or somehow that we're doing something unfair is fascinating to me, given that there's not these conversations about unfairness when these policies historically have advantaged non-people of color. And so, for example, when the housing administration in the 1930s and 40s did redlining that has contributed to the intergenerational transfer of wealth, it has contributed to segregated neighborhoods, that is something that the government did. When the government dishonorably discharged disproportionately black soldiers in World War II, which contributed to them not being able to take advantage of the GI Bill, et cetera, you know, people could make a false claim that this was about their behavior, their inability to perform, but this is also very much about, and probably more so, about the pervasiveness of institutional and individual racism that is enacted in policies, procedures, that is enacted in a personal relationship. And so I think we have to be very careful about this notion about this presence, this notion about being unfair. And I would just lastly say that the Academy probably did not corrupt the term equity, but instead provided nuance, which is what, when we understand things better and think about across time, which is actually what happens. And so even if, for those people who would say, I'm against equity, but I'm not against equality of opportunity, I think the point that the caller from the last caller you read from Oregon, and the point that Lyndon Johnson was making is this: even to have equal access, some equity would need to take place because the starting point itself are not the same. So even if we say, okay, outcome is too lofty, is too idealistic, having equal access to the starting point would require different resources. And I think that's the point we're making.
Yeah, and so let me just follow up with and ask you, is the point that you're making is that in the United States, because of the past 400 years, that we don't, even though the nation may have this worthy aspiration of true equality, that because we haven't fulfilled the tenets of that aspiration, that we don't know. Like, what if we actually did successfully remove barriers from people's lives?
Right.
That we might actually produce equity of outcome that way, but we don't yet know.
Meghna, I think you're hitting it dead on the head, which is that I think the point that I'm making and others of this mind is that the histories of and the legacies of slavery, for one, for Jim Crow segregation, for the assault on the civil rights legislative achievements from the 60s and the moment that we're currently living in, that those legacies actually matter, that those legacies historically have advantaged, large swaths of white populations by promoting anti-black racism and white supremacy, among other forms of discrimination. And that at this point, we're trying to say, let's stop doing that and let's instead focus on the aspirations that the United States set forth in its founding documents, as it at once guaranteed freedom, equality for a large portion of the population, and guaranteed unfreedom for a significantly large portion of the population.
Mm. Mike Gonzalez, your response to that?
Yes, thank you. So very, very briefly on the 3/5 clause, as Robert Patterson knows because he's a professor, that was about limiting the power of slave owners. It was introduced by an abolitionist, James Wilson. Now let's go back to the main point here. The core principle of the civil rights era was that discrimination on the basis of race was evil. That was what the civil rights era promised. In fact, the first use of the term affirmative action came in Jack Kennedy's executive order 10925, which then, and I'm so glad you brought up the Howard University speech, Meghna, LBJ begins to corrupt by bringing up the horse race analogy. That horse race analogy was first employed by Herbert Crowley in the 1890s, one of the progressives. But what was missing then was race. It's LBJ that introduces then the concept of race. And so this is the important thing with the equal outcomes here. And I think Robert Patterson is completely right when he says that it doesn't promise individual equal outcomes. It's worse than that, actually, because it promises, it according to numerical representations in official categories of race, it promises racial parity. This policy, what it does then, is it creates a caste system that is alien to the American ethos. Let me just give you an example. a Chilean origin neurosurgeon, his children will be counted as members of a marginalized group, even though he may be white, in need of greater resources than a lifelong waitress in Pensacola who comes from a generation of white sharecroppers. This is the problem here. Social disadvantage, according to this new policy, is determined at birth and cannot be shaken by success of a successful life. We cannot, this is not 21st century America. This is 17th century India. We cannot have a caste system in this country. That's not what the Constitution promises. That is not what the Civil Rights Act promised. In fact, Hubert Humphrey went on the floor of the Senate and he said, if anybody can find a quota system here, I will eat every page of this bill. And it then became corrupted. And in a way, the way it's being used now, it's never been so pushed to such a degree as we're now seeing in the Biden-Harris administration. We're going to have a great deal of pushback on this because these are fundamental to America, these concepts.
Right. So, Professor Patterson, I'm going to give you a chance here to respond in just a second. But Mike Gonzalez, I wonder, though, could it not be argued that to a certain degree, America does have a kind of caste system already. It's just defined by different means. I'll use the example of the city that I'm sitting here in Boston. There was a study done several years ago that found that the median net wealth of a white family in Boston was somewhere over $100,000. And the median net wealth of a black family in Boston was $8 for a whole variety of reasons. That wealth, of course, as you well know, is transferred from generation to generation, which eventually forms a kind of accreted caste system, if not, the same strict definition as you might have in India, is the example you gave. But we're having the same trends emerge here in this country regardless, don't you think?
Well, what we need to do then is continue what the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the whole era promised, which is remove the obstacles to wealth creation. But look, we must be cognizant of the fact that more likely disparities result from different behaviors, from cultural patterns. This is a vast country with many different geographical subcultures, with peer group values that play a role in how people choose to spend their time, what they choose to study or not study, what they choose to do for a living. We can't equate just the existence of a disparity as we cannot see that as evidence of racism.
Right. Robert Patterson,
what we have to do is remove the obstacles. Government cannot discriminate, and we must remove the obstacles to wealth creation, education, et cetera.
Yeah. Robert Patterson, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to keep this simple and pretty direct. So the first, one of the people will take exception to the issues of equity in the Biden-Harris administration, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, because they're used to, if you're in a group that has constantly been advantaged, if you're in a group that has been deeply invested in these ideas of the histories that I've outlined earlier don't matter, then your way of life, might be changing. And so that might cause some angst, but that doesn't make what they're doing wrong. By any stretch of the imagination. As far as the civil rights movement went and goes, we can talk about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 all we want, but if we look at the whole ethos of the movement, if we look at leaders like Bayard Rustin and others who were calling for a package deal, and the notion of the package deal was that the legislative achievements in the current moment will be one aspect, but there would have to be some affirmative actions that would have to be taken that would, again, close the gaps that exists to get us to where we could have equal access opportunities. But if there's one thing that I really want the listeners on this show to really just step back and think about in their own personal lives and to really take stock of, is that this notion that behaviors and cultural values are the primary, if not over-determining factor of why different groups have unequal access and unequal outcomes, is at the heart of the fiction of meritocracy. It is at the heart of white supremacy and how it disguises itself. It is at the heart of how institutional racism and other forms of discrimination don't get caused and named, because the reality of it is this. even if I had what would be considered normal accruing behaviors, but I did not have access to those institutions, how could I do it? How could I pull myself up with my bootstraps if I don't own any boots because of economic discrimination? And so this notion, this very notion of behavior and cultural values, those are dog whistle politics that help us to miss where anti-Black racism and other forms of discrimination are entering into institutions. And that I orchestrated through people in those institutions.
Mike Gonzalez, we just have 30 seconds to go before we have to take a break, but I'll give you a last thought here.
Yeah, I don't think the use of ad hominems really helps here. It's not going to chill debate. These are issues that need to be discussed. It had nothing to do with anything that Robert Pattinson just discussed. It has to do with why, and I would be very happy if I come back to give examples of how disparities emerge, just out of what it means to self-respect in a subculture. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you derive dignity?
Yeah.
The choices you make.
Well, we've got about 10 seconds before I do have to take that break. But Mike Gonzalez, Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about this concept of vaccine passports. In Israel, people who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can download a little green passport granting them access to spaces like restaurants or live performances. Other countries are considering similar systems. What are the advantages? What are the pitfalls of a vaccine passport idea? Let us know at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Three. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the Biden administration's policy push for equity and how that's different from equality in America in 2021. And I'm joined today by Robert Pattinson. He's a professor of African-American studies at Georgetown University. And Professor Pattinson, there is a point that Mike Gonzalez was making before the break that I want to explore in a little bit more detail, because he talked about the discomfort that he would say unconstitutional nature of crafting government policies on the basis of race. OK, now I want to use a very specific and very recent example. It happened in California in the last election. They had a proposition there, Prop 16, that would end race neutrality in certain state-level policies there. It was Prop 16 was supported by, you know, the brightest lights of the California left, including Vice President Kamala Harris. It was endorsed by almost every major newspaper. Lots of money was spent on it. But voters defeated it there. Voters essentially defeated it by 56 to 40, roughly 44%. And a lot of, and this is in California, right? Seemingly
right.
A true blue state. And it was because many Californians were saying they didn't want to treat people differently on the basis of race or national origin. Others had concerns about the validity of different racial or ethnic categories in a state that's as diverse as California today. And I just wonder what you think about that. Like, so here's one of those tests where policy, like the rubber of policy, was meeting the road and it spun and didn't work. What do you think?
Right. I think a couple of things. So I think that one of the challenges goes back to a point I was making earlier, which is what happens after the legislative achievements of the civil rights movement. And so part of what you would hear through a lot of people who are against affirmative action, for example, policies in the 70s. They would go back and take part of King's speech where he was saying that he wants his children to be judged, for example, by the color, by the content of their character rather than by the color of their skin, which, of course, we know was to mean that he did not want them to be disadvantaged unnecessarily because they were black, right? And so what you then have is this arise of this notion of race neutrality, and the sense that we don't have to account for how race actually matters in a policy's formation or its impact, okay? And so I would just say to say that the defeating of it speaks to a lot of the challenges of the moment and sort of and thinking about race and its history, thinking about ethnic categories, thinking about how it may or may not be enacted. I think that is what the concern is. Is someone going to quote unquote unfairly advantaged versus disadvantaged? And so I think that what happens in these moments is that they're just sort of, to your point, high level policy thinking, but then what's happening on the ground and people's understanding of what's happening, how it's going to play out. And I do think that there is a gap there in messaging, for example, of what's really at stake.
Well, messaging and also, but to your point, the practical considerations. I think this is why maybe this conversation is best had on a policy by policy basis, right? But just, so right. Just to stick with the Prop 16 example for a second, I mean, if it had passed, and I'm quoting from The Atlantic here, California officials might have been forced to decide whether African-American descendants of enslaved people should be treated the same as Nigerian immigrants, or whether folks who identify as Chinese, Indian American, Hmong, Argentine, how do you figure out the differences between those groups in terms of then how California policy would be enacted? That just was not popular with a majority of California voters in a state that's already incredibly diverse. We weren't just asking white people what they thought about that idea.
Right. Exactly. And so you're right. And so I think that to your point that, you know, people are not They are not immune to the different discourses that shape how we understand about race, which is to say, you, for example, could have black people who've internalized some of these ideas that I'm talking about are manifestations of white supremacy. You could have, you know, Asian Pacific Islanders. And so I think that is a widespread because the ideas that I have been talking about in the show, you know, they are widespread values shared across American groups, even if and when they're not necessarily productive to that group's ability to move in a forward direction.
Right. Well, you know, we want to take some time now to really put this conversation or this moment in American history in the broader context of civil rights. We were doing that a little bit more, but if you'll allow me, Professor Patterson, I want to hear from a key civil rights activist from the 1960s, because also we should note that yesterday marked the 56th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day that civil rights activists were attacked by state troopers in Selma, Alabama. Linda Blackman Lowry was there in 1965, including on the Edmund Pettus Bridge when peaceful demonstrators were beaten by the police. She was 15 and the youngest person to walk every step from the march from Selma to Montgomery.
I went to jail 14 times before my 15th birthday.
So what propelled her to activism at such a young age? She says she was just 7 years old when her mother died in childbirth.
She needed blood. There was an all-white hospital here in Selma, and it had blood that could have possibly saved my mother. But it was not Negro blood. At the age of 7, I made a vow that when I got big, I was gonna change things. And nobody would ever have to grow up without a mommy again because of the color of her skin.
So when we asked Lowry about what equality meant to her in the 1960s, she spoke about the Pledge of Allegiance.
It says, with liberty and justice for all. And I could not understand that at 7 years old, because if everybody had justice, they could have gave my mother the blood she needed, and she would not have left us.
She told us that to this day, she does not say the pledge.
The word says liberty and justice for all. I don't see that. When a man can hold a man down with his knee on his neck until he dies, until he stops breathing, where is the justice?
So what does she think about this shift from the word or concept of equality to equity?
Some people might say, well, you have more equity in your home than I have in mine. And then I'll still laugh and say, okay, but that's not equity. That's not fairness. I'm trying to build up my home. You're not trying to build up yours. But when it comes to us selling those homes, because of the color of your skin, you're going to get more money for your home than I'm going to get for mine, no matter how I build it up, because you are white.
Lowry added that she thinks the distinction between equality and equity is important.
You and I both have degrees from prestigious schools, and we sit at a desk across from each other every day. But you make more money than me doing the same job. And I work twice as hard on my job just because I feel I have to prove that I deserve this job. That's not equal equity. That's not even fairness.
Well, in her eyes, Lowry says that advocates for civil rights today may have bigger challenges than even she did in the 1960s.
When I see the George Floyds getting killed, when I hear of the Breonna Taylors and the Sandra Blands, it just makes me feel like I didn't finish my job.
And in the fight for civil rights, Lowry says words hold power.
We in the 60s, we put the word unity back in the word community. Now, you need that word again. You need community, and the word unity is missing. You need humanity. And the word human is missing from there. We need to get those words back in there.
Linda Blackman Lowry. She spoke to us from her home in Selma, Alabama on Saturday. She's author of the book Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. So, Professor Patterson, how do you see this current moment in this in the discussion of equity and how it might be enacted through government policy? How do you see that in this continuum here?
Yeah, I think that. Thank you. But as I was, that story was very moving. As I was happy to be able to hear it, and so in her experience, however unfortunate, with the pledge and kind of what it meant, and all I can think of at that moment, right? She needed blood, but it was a hospital, you know, under Jim Crow segregation that did not serve black communities. And you could have people say, oh, well, they could have chosen to live somewhere differently. But they couldn't have made that choice because, again, all the choices are not equal and they're not the same, which is at the heart of this. As far as the present moment goes, I think that one of the big challenges, but there are two challenges to equity, but they are a continuum of the civil rights movement, and they go hand in hand. The first is this distinction and understanding the distinction between equity and equality and how histories shape that conversation, because these are not isolated conversations that just emerge in the present moment, that they come out of a history extending 400 years of group and individual treatment. So that's one thing. The civil rights movement, of the mid-20th century, it outlawed explicit forms of discrimination against Black people and Black individuals, which was an important feat. And in doing that, it also opened up the window for people to say, oh, well, now that the obstructions to access or the obstructions to equality have been removed legally, the starting points are the same. And there is really no need for any other types of treatment that would account for the history that got us where we are. And so part of what the current movement has to do to get equity is to continue to message, continue to demonstrate through these specific examples, right, of where we know that the behaviors had disproportionate outcomes. So in policy, for example, what would have happened if during the Obama administration, for example, when Countrywide, which then became Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all these big banks who had intentionally engaged in predatory lending to predominantly Black communities and brown people as well, instead of handing them a $1,000, $2,000 payout as a penalty from these big banks, had said to the big banks, you need to give them their house back and pay off the mortgage as the penalty, right? What would that have looked like? So in other words, you have predatory lending that disproportionately takes advantage of Black people and brown people. And people might say, well, they couldn't afford the house. That's not true. People who would have qualified for a non-prime loan were pushed into these loans, as an example. So if you have this as a contemporary example, and so if you take this and say, this is what you did, we're going to give you the penalty is going to be you're going to pay a disproportionate portion of this mortgage off whatever the case is, those would be ways that policies and laws would be start trying to account for these histories of discrimination in very specific ways.
Well, I've just got to jump in here for a second because we only have 2 minutes left, Professor Patterson.
Sorry about that.
And no, it's okay. I hear the potency of your ideas. But again, we're talking about policy from the federal government, which is bound by law and the Constitution.
Right.
And this is where we've been hearing in the confirmation hearings, for example, a lot of tension. So I just want to play a particular moment. Here's Republican Senator Tom Cotton questioning President Biden's nominee for HUD Secretary Marcia Fudge, again, on this definition between equity. And here's their interaction.
So just to be clear, then, it sounds like racial equity means treating people differently based on their race. Is that correct?
Not based on race, but it could be based on economics. It could be based on the history of discrimination that has existed for a long time. It could be based on educational levels. It could be based on many things, not necessarily just race.
Is it ever appropriate for the government to treat people differently based on their race?
No.
So, Professor Patterson, we've just got a minute left here, but this is going to come up again and again in every conversation about understanding equality and equity. I mean, even Marcia Fudge there even saying we can't have policies that are based on race.
I'm glad you played that, and I misspoke earlier. I said Rand Paul, but it was Tom Cotton. Yeah. That was actually the clip I was talking about. What I think the point is that I thought what she said, not just race, but it could be other categories of identity too. So I didn't see she was saying no to race. The point here is sort of why is it that you're doing what you're doing? And so treating someone differently in this case is trying to get a fairer or better outcome, whereas treating them the same, that wouldn't be the case.
Well, Robert Patterson is a professor of African American Studies at Georgetown University, currently at work on a book titled Black Equity, Black Equality, Reparation, and Black Communities. Professor Patterson, thank you so much for joining us for what I feel is only just the beginning of a much longer conversation that we will continue to have on this show. So I really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.